In just a moment, Biographies in Sound. But first, join movie actor Robert Stack tomorrow when he makes his appearance on NBC's Weekday. And remember that the best variety entertainment comes your way every Monday through Friday on this favorite of daytime radio services. There's music with Meredith Wilson, drama in the form of a serialized novel, Taylor Caldwell's Tender Victory. Then you'll also profit by valuable information features, food news with Charlotte Adams, child care advice by Dr. Francis Horwich, and timely vacation hints offered on Walter Kiernan's Summer School. Here, Weekday tomorrow. And now stay tuned for Biographies in Sound on NBC.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to witness a most unusual performance. May I take this opportunity to extend to you the thanks of the City of New York for your participation here this evening. We are going to have everything from symphony to tap. And now, the show is on.
And the show was on. It ran nearly 65 years. The man in the title role could be amusing, aggravating, but never dull.
The National Broadcasting Company presents the transcribed story of Fiorello LaGuardia, the little giant of Gotham, a biography in sound, told in his own voice and the voices of his friends and foes. Among them you will hear Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, Mrs. Marie LaGuardia, House Majority Leader John McCormick, former Mayor William O'Dwyer, and motion picture producer Walter Wanger, with their memories of a man who kept the world's greatest city well-governed and well-entertained. Your narrator is Mr. Grover Whalen, who served LaGuardia and other mayors as New York City's official master of ceremonies.
Fiorello was the whole show. He stood only 5 feet too tall, was so overweight, he refused to step on a scale. But he could never be upstaged. Here's a quick review of his performance. First, a president's wife.
It was so difficult to put your finger on and have sit for 5 minutes. He was doing so many different things, so that you went ahead and did things without him. And you were just as apt to have your head taken off for having done them as not, because he had a very quick temper.
Fiorello's friend and political mentor.
Fiorello's egoism. Actually, he was personally a very humble man. He could explode like a bomb. But individually, it was not the kind of man you think he was at all. That was strictly for public purposes.
His political foe.
He didn't seem to know what fear was. He seemed to be at his very best when things were at their very worst. He possibly would not have been half the mayor in good times that he was when things were in a tragic condition.
His daughter.
For whatever else he was, it would have been enough for me if he had been as great a father as he was.
We'll tell you that Fiorello was born in New York City on December 11, 1882, and died in the same city on September 20, 1947, a span of almost 65 years. But those are the only vital statistics we'll give you for now, and pick up the story with some men who knew Fiorello as a young lawyer in Manhattan shortly after the turn of the century. Mr. Edward Corsi, former United States Commissioner of Immigration.
It was very difficult for LaGuardia to practice law. He never made money out of the law because he never had the heart to charge. He would do an enormous amount of free work. He would take on the cases of people in his district by the dozens, you see, and a great deal of his time was put in solving the personal problems of people in his territory.
Mr. Roger Baldwin. president of the American Civil Liberties Union.
He made his early reputation in defending clients in civil liberties cases, which are almost always unpopular cases. He made his reputation for being a friend of the common man and a friend of the underdog. And since the world is full of underdogs, naturally he had a large following.
And I want to say to you young students, if you want to be a constitutional lawyer, all you have to do is, when you grow up and you're admitted to the bar, get yourself a pair of spats, light pearl color, a cutaway coat, and speak in a nice, mild voice. And you're a constitutional lawyer. And never abuse the court.
Mr. Jacob Potowski, president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America.
Organized labor, we regarded him as one of our own, and we supported him wholeheartedly. He's been very active in our early beginnings, back in 1912, when we first started organizing in the city of New York. And he had just come out of law school. He was our lawyer and was very active on the picket line.
Edward Cossey.
He took an interest in the politics of his district. That was the old 14th district downtown New York, which was represented in Congress by a gentleman by the name of Farley, who evidently seemed unbeatable in that area. And I think he was a saloon keeper by profession. So the Republicans decided one day, since the case was so hopeless, to name little Fiorello LaGuardia. LaGuardia was the only one who wanted to take a chance on running for Congress. He felt he could win. He didn't win the first time, but he won the second time. He beat the machine by his characteristic methods of campaigning. LaGuardia had great confidence in a direct appeal to the people. He didn't believe in machines. And his type of campaigning was street corner campaigning. He would stand up on a soapbox and he would talk to people. He would speak in whatever language the occasion called for. If it was an Italian audience before him, he would speak Italian and English. If it was a Jewish audience, he'd speak Yiddish and English. And so he became the congressman from the Greenwich Village District of New York.
Fiorello's first day in the House of Representatives was April 2nd, 1917, the day Woodrow Wilson came to the Congress and asked for a declaration of war to make the world safe for democracy. Fiorello had prepared himself for that war, taking flying lessons at Mineola, Long Island. Fiorello took a leave of absence to go overseas as an officer in the air service. One of the men under his command was Walter Wenger, now the Hollywood motion picture producer.
I first met Fiorello LaGuardia at the railway station in Paris when a fat little captain, who later became a major, came along to the car and said, "You boys are going down to Italy with us. I'm Captain LaGuardia." And that was my first meeting with Fiorello LaGuardia, a very great man whom we all became very fond of in the ensuing months, where we were in probably the safest place in Europe, the Italian training camp at Foggia. Foggia was a pretty unattractive place at the time, and there were a lot of political problems involved. And in all of these political and propaganda matters, LaGuardia was of great service because he was an Italian and knew how to handle things. Incidentally, LaGuardia really ran his own war, interpreting all the rules and regulations as he saw fit, and he was usually right. LaGuardia would take off to Naples and make a speech, or go up to Rome and talk to the authorities, or go up to Padova, which was the general headquarters, and talk to General Diaz and General Bedoya, or the king.
But how good a pilot was he?
LaGuardia was not a finished, polished pilot. He sort of flew by main strength and awkwardness, but He got there just the same.
LaGuardia's biographer, Lowell Olympus, former city editor of the New York Daily News.
He commanded the respect of his men because of the way he repeatedly endangered his life.
Fiorello almost lost his life twice in plane crashes during the war. But he survived and came back to Congress briefly. He waged a fight in the primaries for mayor in 1921 and lost. After a while,
he came up and was a candidate for Congress in the East Harlem District. That's the district on the Upper East Side of New York, one of the most congested districts in America.
Edward Corsi tells us the story.
It was an ideal district for LaGuardia, predominantly a district of people of Jewish and Italian backgrounds, about half and half. He did win in the district. He won in 1922. He carried the district by a handsome plurality. And he continued to serve that district for years until he was defeated in the Roosevelt landslide of 1932.
John McCormick, now majority leader of the House of Representatives, who was a young congressman then.
The Norris LaGuardia Act is one of the most important affecting our internal economy and progress that has passed the Congress in decades. It is properly called labor's Magna Carta. The late Fiorello LaGuardia introduced this important and far-reaching bill in the National House of Representatives. It was bitterly opposed by the big interest. I well remember this historic legislative battle of progress and of the emancipation of human beings. The bill passed the House under the leadership of Mr. LaGuardia. His leadership was superb.
LaGuardia had a great deal more influence in Congress than he deserved to have.
Again, low Olympus.
Because he was a lone wolf. He was a maverick. He had made himself a master of congressional parliamentary procedure. The leaders of the party certainly didn't approve of anything that Fiorello ever said. And they started out choking him off. But he was always bobbing up with some kind of a point of personal privilege or a point of order or something of the sort. And I have seen him, in asking one question, work in a 30-minute speech before he finished a single sentence. And then the result was that he put across a number of things with which his name will always be connected: labor legislation, such as the Norris-LaGuardia Act, impeachment of federal judges, things of that sort. He was one of the pioneer wets opposing prohibition in this country, and he loved to dramatize things, as on that occasion when he announced beforehand that he was going to make beer on the steps of the Capitol and invited all the prohibition agents to come and watch him do it and arrest him if they dared. And he went right through with it, and they watched him, and they decided not to touch him.
So far as my own connection is concerned, this began in the so-called lame duck Congress after President Roosevelt had been elected President of the United States and before he had taken office on March 4th, 1933.
A. Burley, Jr., former Assistant Secretary of State.
This was a Congress of pure chaos. I'd been President Roosevelt's brain trust. We knew that there was a lot of legislation we were going to have passed very rapidly after inauguration. To do that, you have to make a record first. I went to the then Speaker of the House, Jack Garner, later Vice President, and said, "To whom can we go to get some action in this Congress?" And he said, "You'll have to go to a little Italian congressman from New York named Fiorello LaGuardia. He's the only man that can make this house do anything." So I arranged then to meet Fiorello LaGuardia and found this short, dynamic person. He was a pint of liquid dynamite.
It was Adolph Burley who mustered together the political alliance that first elected Fiorello as mayor in 1933.
Prior to the election of Mayor LaGuardia, there was a very famous inquiry into the city government, the Judge Samuel Seabury investigation.
Justice Irving Ben Cooper, now of the Court of Special Sessions in New York, took part in that probe.
That inquiry shows most eloquently the extent of corruption, degradation, insolence in public office, how foul a government can be. There was hardly a commissioner who hadn't participated in graft. And so it was an aroused electorate who went to the polls at the conclusion of the Seabury investigation and cast an overwhelming vote of victory for LaGuardia.
Well, LaGuardia was a good government, good management man. And the times in which he served the city, the times of depression and later on war, naturally favored his inherent thrift with public funds.
One of his staunchest critics through the years, Harold Riegelman of the Citizens Budget Commission.
But when you're thrifty, you hurt people. And after his election, all was sweetness and light, but liberally intermixed with thunder and lightning and verbal avalanches. Let me tell you, when LaGuardia flayed anybody, LaGuardia really made the fur fly. He was a master of invective, and a fight with him meant no holes were barred.
The shifts that we put to get the city back on its financial feet or something, but it got back.
A.A. Burley.
Fiorello's routine was a stiff one. You'd get a telephone call the night before, and he'd say, "You ought to go out with me." When? 5:00 tomorrow morning. All right. Then you would show up at his apartment way up on Fifth Avenue, beyond where Fifth Avenue is fashionable. And here would be a couple of cars, and you'd get in, and you'd sail off. The next place you'd come to would be one of the city institutions. It was not announced. Fiorello would try to get there just about breakfast time, or just before, and the first place he'd begin would be the kitchen, which he would look at the line of breakfasts coming along, or however it was, and take some himself. If it was edible, he noted that. If it wasn't edible, and at that time it frequently was not, then the roof began to go off the building. He went through that building from top to bottom, and then by the time he got through, if it wasn't in good shape, he'd blow the window out.
At that time, we had 1,300,000 people on relief in this city. That's an awful lot of people.
Ed Corsi.
And we spent about $30 million a month between work relief and home relief. I remember when LaGuardia decided to quit City Hall, he picked me up there and took me up to Gracie Mansion. And he began to reminisce a little bit about the years that he had served the city. And when he came to this question of relief, there were almost tears in his eyes. And he looked at me and he said, "We fed him, didn't we, Ed? We fed him."
We had an alliance between the mayor and the president. For one thing, since we needed jobs, we got an awful lot of public works. As you look around New York City today, a lot of the things that you see came right out of that. One of them, for instance, is the East River Drive, the Franklin D. Roosevelt Drive, which goes from downtown New York straight up the East River. You'll see that running all the way up to 125th Street, where it picks up the Triborough Bridge. Another one, in due time, was the Triborough Bridge itself. The public housing, again, some of the bills that Fiorello had prepared before he became mayor of New York, we put in for. And you see a good many of the public housing units, which were at that time financed through what is today the Federal Housing Administration, the so-called FHA. We got a lot of the park work done. Central Park was in large measure rehabilitated that way.
The reason he was a genius at getting federal grants was because he was the only mayor that went down with blueprints.
Mr. Newbold Morris, who served under Fiorello as president of the city council.
The other mayors went down with demands and ideas, but he came down with complete blueprints, all ready to go. I remember one night we took a night off. We went to see a film at Radio City Music Hall. You know, when the crowds file out after the feature is over, for a moment the spotlight shines on the left-hand side of the stage where an organist is playing the organ. And I remember LaGuardia nudging me as we took our seats, and he said, "You know, that's the way you have to run the city of New York, with both hands on the keyboard and both feet on the pedals, and you never let go."
One of Fiorello's biggest projects was the airport that bears his name, LaGuardia. Despite opposition and ridicule, Fiorello pushed it through, then went on to plan Idlewild, or International Airport. He was a pilot himself, and he could foresee the growth of aviation.
He resented the fact that Newark was the major airport to serve the whole metropolitan area of New York, and it rankled him.
Red Mosher, senior vice president of the American Airlines, and Fiorello's old friend, tells us.
He was on a carrier coming in from the Midwest with a ticket reading New York. The airplane terminated at Newark. LaGuardia refused to get off the airplane. All other passengers were off, and the baggage were off, and he stayed on. He flashed his ticket and said his ticket said New York, and Newark, New Jersey was not New York, and that they had to take him to New York. Well, glad that the carrier had a sense of knowledge of LaGuardia's forcefulness, because they debated it a while and finally cranked it up and flew into Floyd Bennett and let him off, returned back to Newark.
The Seabury investigation proved corruption in New York City. What did Fiorello do about it? Here's the man who succeeded him as mayor, William O'Dwyer.
I'd say that the Fiorello LaGuardia was always afraid of everyone around him when it came to corruption. He was always watching for it, if it were there, and he knew about it, that would be the end of it. The trouble is that it can be there, and the most, the greatest vigilance in the world sometimes can't disclose it for a long, long time.
This is pretty hot territory for grafters in my administration. And so far, we've been rather fortunate. If I catch any of them, we'll send them to jail.
Every Sunday, on the air, he served notice to tin horns and gamblers to clear out of town.
Newbold Morris.
And two very famous gamblers did leave town during LaGuardia's administration, and both their first names were Frank. Frank Costello and Frank Erickson. And both of them found it was more comfortable to go to New Jersey. One of Mayor LaGuardia's first acts was to close up all of the slot machines, confiscated them, took them out on barges into the ocean, personally cracked them up with a sledgehammer, and had them dumped overboard.
Fiorello honestly believed he was at City Hall to work. Here's his secretary, Miss Betty Cohn.
The mayor started his day very early at home, very often by having breakfast with one of his commissioners or some official. He also had a telephone in his car, a two-way radio telephone, and he had a little makeshift desk in his car, and at one time he had a dictaphone in his car, so that he was busy all the way downtown. There was a surprise almost every minute, and some of the things were fantastic. Some of them were beautiful. Some of them were very exciting. Some of them were horrible. The mayor was a very impatient person when a file was missing. Sometimes, well, you just felt as though the place was going to fall apart. Very often, the file couldn't be found. I even called up the mayor's tailor one day and found a file that was in his pocket when he had sent his suit over to the tailor's to be pressed.
I was no match for him. He could, he knew parliamentary procedure. He knew how to deal with matters, and I more than ever.
James J. Lyons, then and now, former president of the Bronx, was a friend of Fiorello's, even though they were political foes.
I remember one matter that I was interested in, and he was annoyed that morning on something, and he said, I'll take care of you. So he moved it. He moved my matter. And then they all voted it down. Oh, nobody voting for it but myself. Then he moved to reconsider it, and I thought maybe he'd change his heart. And instead of that, after reconsideration, he moved it again. And same procedure. They voted it down with nobody voting for myself. So I said, what do you have to do a thing like that twice for? He said, I'm doing it twice, he said, because now you can't bring it up. It was killed twice, and it's killed forever.
He was a great fellow for going to fires.
Hal Riegelman.
You see this little fella in his rubber coat and his tin hat? And he really had a wonderful time at the fires, but he did get in the people's way. However, the important thing was that he was at the fire, thereby demonstrating to the public that he was watching what was going on and wasn't afraid to share with the regular firemen the hazards of their calling.
Fiorello had to fight hard to keep his job as mayor, particularly in 1941, when he was elected to his last of three terms at City Hall. Alf Burley tells how he fought.
Well, as campaigner, Fiorello was one of the men who had absolutely no illusions. He used to say, I can demagogue and I can argue. But you can't campaign on the streets of New York as though you were in a Columbia classroom. In general, he always began with some problem that was directly related to the precise block or district in which he was. He knew the entire city of New York from Staten Island to the Westchester line, and not only what went on in each part of it, but what the racket was in that section, too. It would be three or four sentences of almost hesitating, soft speech, followed by a crash line that went right into consciousness.
Now you have the right to ask me, Mr. Mayor, what do you mean by a system? I mean a close political machine. A machine that has the power to reach his hand out and select an individual and say, you're the candidate. And this person, regardless of how he may feel individually, but knowing full well that any office that he has held has been through this same machine, has no choice in the matter but to accept. And then this machine wages an effective campaign in his behalf, and he is elected. And then this machine, with a cold eye, looks at him after election and says, we selected you. We elected you. Your picture is in the paper. You're on the front page. Who are you? You're nothing. You're nobody. You're it all to us.
He was a fellow who had inner convictions about his own destiny that were amazing.
Once more, Ed Cossey.
He believed in breaks. He believed in lucky corners. And in his campaign, he would think that that if he'd missed a meeting, for instance, at 116th Street and Lexington Avenue, on the eve of election, on a lucky corner, he would be defeated.
Former President Lyons.
He was always against that machine politics and tin horns and clubhouse loafers and all that sort of thing. I said to him, why you say you're not a politician? I said, you're a master. But he had to attack something. He had to get something that had good news value.
Fiorello almost lost the 1941 mayoralty campaign to Bill O'Dwyer.
The truth is, there were no great issues at all in that campaign. Now, what issue could you have against a man like LaGuardia? It was a popularity contest. Just political blah-blah. It was just down to that level. That 1941 campaign had nothing in the nature of a basic criticism of Fiorello LaGuardia or his administration. Fiorello one day was in the marketplace uptown New York, I think it was around 125th Street. He picked up a head of cabbage and he said, "It looks like my opponent." That was Fiorello. And anyone that would take offense at a thing like that just didn't belong in politics to begin with.
O'Dwyer lost in 41, but came back to beat Newball Morris in the Morality campaign of 1945. During the war, Fiorello had tried again to get back into service, but it didn't work out. However, he did help the war effort as National Director of Civil Defense. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt tells us of one incident.
I was asked to serve under him as Assistant Director in charge of women's activities when civilian defense was organized. And I took with him one trip, the first trip to the coast, when there were rumors that the coast was going to be attacked. I was amused on that trip because the rumors came to us during the night, and they came and told me about them because I hadn't gone to bed, and he had. And I had to wake him up. Everybody else was afraid to wake him up, to ask him if Los Angeles airport was closed, what he wanted to do. And his answer was that I was to get off at the next stop and find out where the attacks were supposed to be, and we would go right there. And so I went and discovered that the rumors of attacks were not very well substantiated.
After the war, Fiorello spent some of his last months of his life as Director General of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. Again, his most useful tool was his irrepressible tongue.
If I've accomplished anything, it's simply to try to pull up when I saw things going down. I can assure you it was all in a day's work. And perhaps, I think you'll all believe this, if I had deliberated, perhaps I wouldn't have said some of the things that I do say and shall continue to say from time to time. So anytime I may say something, you know that it's mine and that no one studied about it and considered it and then gave it to me.
This has been part one of The Little Giant of Gotham, the story of Fiorello LaGuardia, a biography in sound. Part two follows in a moment after a station identification.
New York, New York, oh, what a charming city. The poet Carl Sandburg. On Broadway, the Bowery, he rambled up and down. In highways and byways, resolved to see the town. And as he went, he sang this song. Now isn't it a pity that I should stay away so long from this delightful city? New York, New York, oh, what a charming city.
You may have heard that this great metropolis of 7.5 million is perhaps too large or too busy to be hospitable. You'll find that that is not true. You'll find that we're just the same kind of folks that you've left back home, whether in the West, in the South, or in the North, or up in New England. You'll find real folks here in New York.
Fiorello LaGuardia was born in Greenwich Village, New York City, Yet he knew whereof he spoke when he talked about the rest of the country. His parents were immigrants, not long arrived. His father from Italy, his mother from Trieste. His father, Achille, was a man of culture, a musician and a composer. Not long after Fiorello was born, his father was appointed a bandmaster in the United States Army. Then the family started on the move. First to upstate New York, to South Dakota, and to Wimple Barracks, Arizona, near Prescott. There were three children, Fiorello, Richard, and Gemma. Now only Gemma survives. Mrs. Gemma Gluck.
We would have to walk a mile to go to school. And of course, Fiorello had to be the leader. He used to lead the path that we had to go, you know, and make excitements and this and that. And in school, he was a very good scholar. Never looked in his book and laughed at me that I was studying always. Oh, he was about 11, 12 years old that he used to jump on the table to make speeches. And we all had to keep quiet, we other children who were playing our own games, we had to keep quiet and listen to him. In Arizona, my father made a musical club. And I played first violin, my brother played cornet. The weekend, our summer vacations, we had camping. And that in Arizona was only on mountains. We all had donkeys. And Fiorello was a cook. And the best fried potatoes I ever ate, he made.
LaGuardia was always proud of his Western background.
And Corsi.
And in spite of the fact that he was very much of a New Yorker, he always had fond remembrance and fond affection for the old West, where the cowboys were that he knew as a boy, the army post. LaGuardia's thinking, LaGuardia's outlook, was the outlook of the Western American more than it was of the product of the tenements.
Look, the mighty country we have. Look at our factories and mills and railroads and roads. Who built them? The immigrants built them. The immigrants built them. When I was a boy out west, I saw the first railroad come in there in Arizona in the early 90s. What were they? Mexicans and Italians. $1.25 a day, working 10 and 12 hours. And if he was injured, he lost his job. Who do you suppose built this country? Immigrants. And there's still a great deal to do.
With the Spanish-American War, the father's regiment was called away to fight. Fiorello, age 16, too young to enlist, enticed the St. Louis Post-Dispatch to pay his way to go with his father and send back some story. He did send back some stories, but Fiorello and his father never reached the fighting front. Because of food poisoning, Fiorello's father was discharged from the army. He lived as an invalid a few more years, long enough to take his family back to Europe. They settled in Trieste. Fiorello took a job with the American consulate in Budapest, was soon promoted to United States consul at the port of the city of Fiume. These were gay years for Fiorello, parties and music and young ladies. Once he almost had to fight a duel with a Hungarian army officer over a tiff with a young lady at a masked ball. There were also years of work. But in 1906, Fiorello decided this was not the career for him.
I am not a diplomat. I started in the diplomatic service 37 years ago. But, you know, I had a queer fault. I liked to tell the truth, so I wasn't a success in the diplomatic service. So I became a congressman.
LaGuardia came back after that, and he wanted to study law.
Ed Corsi again.
So he got himself a job, and he got himself a job as an interpreter at Ellis Island. And so he interpreted during the day and studied law at night. When I was commissioner of immigration at Ellis Island, I asked that I be given LaGuardia's personnel file. And it contained just about two or three sheets of paper, but a letter from the commissioner asking little Fiorello not to talk too much. But that was the only thing. His record was good. He was a very conscientious worker. LaGuardia was always conscientious, hard working. He knew no hours. Ellis Island is a great training place for people who are interested in people. He actually saw the world at the gates of New York. It was an experience you couldn't buy for a man who wanted later to go into public life as he did.
But the law and politics were not Fiorello's only interests. Here's his biographer, Low Olympus.
This newly graduated lawyer, just getting started, met at some kind of a party the beautiful Miss Almira Gatti and promptly lost his heart to her and started. She had a great many suitors and he just joined the mob trailing around after her. That was here in New York. And ultimately, he started proposing to her almost every time he got a chance. And I gathered that Thea wasn't overly impressed by him in the beginning. She liked him and learned to respect him. But it wasn't until after he came back from World War I that the feeling between them developed into real love and Thea finally agreed to marry him. The real tragedy was that Thea suddenly developed tuberculosis shortly. I guess she'd had it before. But it became very serious shortly after the birth of the baby. And the baby had TB too. And they didn't discover that it was really serious until Fiorello was out actually campaigning for mayor. That would have been in 1921. And for a while, the man lived a kind of a nightmare. He was out fighting for this nomination, making speeches, attending political meetings, and then he'd come home and walk the floor at night with his sick baby and try to take care of his sick wife, and it seemed like the whole business collapsed at the same time. When the baby died, Thea couldn't even go to the funeral. He had to go and bury the baby himself, and a week later his wife was dead. He'd been defeated in the primary. It looked like the end of his political career. It looked like the end of everything. But his secretary, who in later years became his second wife, a very fine, brilliant, and lovely woman, Marie LaGuardia, she sort of came to the rescue, built a wall of silence around him, and brought him back into public life, persuaded him to run for office again. That was the time he ran for Congress the second time. And she gets a great deal of credit for salvaging LaGuardia.
We were married in 1929, just before the close of Congress in February 1929.
Marie Fisher, Fiorello's secretary, who became Mrs. Fiorello LaGuardia.
And then took a trip to Panama. Spent, I guess it was about two or three weeks in Panama. Of course, Fiorello was always very conscientious about his work. He thought being away two or three weeks was a terrible long time.
Fiorello and Marie adopted two children, Jean and Eric. And Fiorello set out to raise his family well. Here is Adolf Burley.
This was a very sweet, quiet man who liked to play with his children, listen to the music on the radio, and have lamb stew, and if there were going to be an exploding, Marie could attend to that. The exact opposite of the bombastic, egoistic figure you think of.
He was a very easy person to talk to. He was
Fiorello's daughter, Miss Jean LaGuardia.
Apart from just being a warm and wonderful person, he you felt that he really was interested in even the trivial events, which, of course, to you were not trivial.
Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt tells us.
He came once to see me when I had an apartment, and I was up here from Washington on 11th Street, and he had to climb 3 flights of stairs. And he arrived breathless at the top of 3 flights of stairs. I don't think he ever climbed any stairs. And I had ordered lunch out on the balcony, and I had a colored maid who was so petrified the idea of having lunch for the mayor that my secretary, Miss Thompson, had to go in and get lunch. And it was a very light and sketchy lunch. And when it was over, he looked at me solemnly and he said, "I shall not have to lie to my wife when I go home today as to what I ate for lunch."
He would come in the door, throw his hat and call, "Marie," and if I wasn't there, it wasn't good. I don't think he ever had a typical evening ever at home. Everything, you know, everything was always different with him. An evening at home would be having friends in, having made perhaps a few highballs before dinner, and he never would get home, you know, very early. He would sit and read, listen to radio.
When we rented a house out on Long Island, my brother and I, and there were some other assorted relatives of youngish age, my father decided that at least on weekends he was going to run the system like an army camp, sort of, because this was a hearkening back, I'm sure, to his days as an army brat. So he bought a bugle, which he blew very well. So he would blow this, the right bugle call for chow or whatever it is, and then he would blow another bugle call for everybody lining up for allowances, and he would drill us on the beach. This was great fun. He was very, very interested in teaching us all the time. He had all kinds of ways of doing this. I think that a great deal of his taking us to public functions, the opening of highways and bridges and tunnels and, oh, big things like the World's Fair. Well, he wanted us to see this. One Saturday, I remember very clearly, he decided to show my brother and I the way the sewage disposal system in New York City worked, how the sewers worked and what it was all for. And the first thing he did was take us to the corner and open a manhole. And we peered down in this manhole, and the whole jaunt ended with a trip to the sewage disposal plant out on the island that's out there by the Triborough Bridge. And we saw this from top to bottom.
Fiorello loved a prank, particularly when the target was his doctor and old friend, Dr. George Baer.
One day I said to Fiorello, "Fiorello, I haven't had a specimen from you in some time. On your way down to City Hall, I'd like you to drop off a bottle at my office," which he did. As he passed on his way down, he left this bottle. It was examined, and about 2 hours later, while I was holding my office hours, there was a call from City Hall. The mayor's on the telephone. And he says, "George," he said, "did you examine that specimen?" And I said, "Yes, I did, Fiorello." He said, "How was it?" I said, "It was negative." "Oh, George, you sure you examined it?" And I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Did it have any sugar in it?" I said, "No, Fiorello, no sugar." He said, "It did." I said, "It didn't." He said, "It did." I said, "It didn't." He said, "It did." Well, I said, "How do you know it did?" He said, "Because I put it in." So I said, "Fiorello, the joke's on you. Did you put that in from the sugar bowl?" He said, "Yes." I said, "That's saccharose. That isn't the sugar we test for. We test for dextrose, and the reaction isn't given by sucrose."
Most people knew Fiorello only as a voice on the radio. But what a voice.
There was a newspaper delivery strike. A couple of children objected very strenuously that they weren't going to get the funnies on Sunday. So the mayor decided he would read the funnies for them. He got the newspapers and he read them over the air. It was just too bad it wasn't television. He would jump up and down in his seat and his hands would fly all over the place, and he'd laugh and he'd grin and he'd cry with the funnies. Everything, he just lived them.
"Now, children, I know you're all disappointed today that you didn't get the funnies.
So gather around, and I'll tell you about Dick Tracy today. Here's Dick Tracy. Let's see what Dick Tracy is doing. Now, get this picture. Here is Red Wash. The doors of the laundry wagon are open. He's leaning with his back toward the wagon, and he's counting his money. 2, 3, 4,000. Now he's getting into the hundreds. 600, 700, 800. And the picture shows a hand of Breathless stretching out. She's got hold of that iron pot. Remember the iron pot she took from the Van Hoosen's gardener's flat to put the money in? And crash! She crashes it on his head. Knocked out. And say, children, what does it all mean? It means that dirty money never brings any luck.
Howard Cullman, chairman of the Port of New York Authority.
We were having some difficulty between the city administration and the Port Authority, and Fiorello phoned me one Saturday afternoon and said, Howard, you listen to the radio tomorrow at 12 o'clock. I'm going to give you the diggins. I said, what about? And he went on in a great rate and said, you just listen. Well, I took an extra drink, and at noon the next day I was before the radio. But thanks to a newspaper strike, instead of attacking me in the Port Authority, he read the funnies. Immediately after broadcast, he called me and said, oh boy, were you lucky. And I admitted I was.
He had a great sentimental streak in him. You know, he wrote short stories.
Ed Corsi.
I had one of his short stories that he gave me to read one time. It was written, of course, years before he became mayor. He had a side to him which the public had very little chance to see. He was greatly interested in the arts and artists. He loved to live among the bohemian people, the creative people. And he regarded himself as belonging to the creative elements in the community. He loved music intensely. He would spend many hours listening to music, and whenever he got a chance, he would go to concerts.
And Al Burley remembers.
We went to a symphony concert. He had tickets in the second balcony of Carnegie Hall for himself and his wife for many, many years to listen to the Philharmonic. Toscanini had left, and the Philharmonic wasn't doing so well under a new conductor, though he was an excellent conductor, I mean a different conductor. And we sat through the first piece, and it was dragging, and Fiorello was getting angrier as he went along. Just as soon as the intermission came, he beckoned me. Come along, he said. We went down and backstage, and Fiorello came in there, and he got up on the nearest box, and he pounded for attention. Then, in perfectly good Italian, a great many of these men were Italian, and some English, he proceeded to give them what for, as only he could do it. He said, you're cheating the public. He says, you're not giving the conductor anything. He's a good conductor, and you're not giving them a single bit of verb or spirit. He said, you're a disgrace to the city of New York. He said, I'm sitting in the second balcony of this is the hall, and I'm going to listen to the next movement. And if you don't play a lot better and with a lot more zip than you're playing now, I'll get up right there and I'll denounce you from the hall itself and tell the audience to go and get its money back. Now stop your nonsense. And then he stumped out. They did play better.
Oh, I wonder how many of you have ever heard Stokowski lead one of his Bach orchestrations. It's the most thrilling I've ever heard in all my life. I'm quite sure, because I don't know what's going to happen on the Judgment Day. But when Judgment Day comes and all sorts of acquaintances will be renewed and all sorts of acquaintances will be made, I am quite sure that Sebastian Bach will come out from the great multitude and say, I want to meet Stokowski. He has arranged and he has rendered my music as I thought someday it might be performed.
For my friend Fiorello LaGuardia,
the music and laughter ended at 7:22 in the morning, September 20th, 1947, in a sick room at his home in Riverdale, New York. The show closed.
In his last illness,
Fiorello's doctor, George Baer,
he for the first time was presented with a great opportunity to make a little money for his family. He was no longer mayor, but he was sought after by the radio people to broadcast as a commentator. And he did take a job as a commentator. But then he took sick. Following his return from UNRWA as the director general of UNRWA, he took sick with his final illness and rapidly became very ill. But as long as he could stand on his feet, as long as he could still move, he went to the broadcasting station and broadcast every day because his family needed the money.
Before Fiorello became too ill, he kept very active and busy. He was at home. He was home most of the time, and he was writing an article for one of the newspapers, PM, I believe. He also had a column in, I think it was the News, and started working on his own book. He finished a very small part of it, but it was published, The Making of an Insurgent. The hard part was when he was really getting too ill to do any work, which made him very miserable and very unhappy.
I was in his house the night that he died. He had had cancer. For the last few days, of course, he had been unconscious, and there was nothing to do there but to go and inquire and sit and wait. Every kind of person was either coming through or calling up or trying to establish connections. This would be some old woman peddling candy on the sidewalk. It would be somebody very great and famous. It would be an ambassador from a foreign country. It would be every representative of every kind and class and condition of men. Obviously, the family was protecting itself a little bit from that. The next day, after his death, his body lay in state in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people went through merely to look at a dead friend who had now nothing to offer. They had nothing to fear. It was merely paying a tribute to a man who, more than any other thing, had given back to the city of New York its self-respect. O'Dwyer was mayor then. As bitter a political enemy of Fiorello LaGuardia and everything he represented as a man could possibly be, when in early morning the news came that Fiorello had died, Bill O'Dwyer half-masted the city's flags in memory and in honor of the greatest mayor that New York has had in our times.
All right. Tomorrow we'll be on the job again. I hope nothing happens tonight. I don't think it will because the weather's in our favor. And I want you to know that your city's on the job. The police department, the fire department, you're just working hard. There are no more hours, you know, for city employees. We just have to work and have to work all the time. Now, carry on. Be cheerful, cooperate, and I'll talk to you again very soon. Good night.
This has been the transcribed story of Fiorello LaGuardia, the little giant of Gotham, a biography in sound, written and edited by Larry Sims, and produced by NBC News for the NBC Radio Network.